This is the second session of an interview with Harry Medlin on the 31st of August 2007, interviewer Rob Lynn. Harry, so you get through your course, and I guess you've got a very fixed mind on what you want to achieve by then that came out of your war experiences and all that. What led you to go to Cambridge to carry on your work?
In Timor, I need to go back a little bit. In Timor, there was an Air Force flight lieutenant called Brian Rofe. He's the father of Paul Rofe, you know, the former DPP. After we got to Timor, we found that our communications, there was an airfield at Penfui. There was a fixed defence at Clapalima. These are about 7 miles apart, I suppose. The forward base was up at Jamplong. There was a big ring road round round Timor, and Jamplong was on the up country side of the junction of the ring road. There was one road then only up from Dutch Timor into Portuguese Timor and to Dili. Penfui was bombed on Australia Day 1942, 26th of January. Brian Rofe and I were in the command post, because after we'd been there a little while, all our communications were either cut, probably by Japanese agents who were in Timor, or the radios grew fungus and stuff. I mean, the rate at which stuff grows in the tropics is incredible. And none of our gear had been properly tropicalised to prevent this happening, so the radios wouldn't work. So we set up on the Air Force Penfui a combined defence centre. And I had been acting adjutant to the Chief Royal Engineer in Darwin immediately up until we left, and I'd got some sort of reputation for, I don't know, being able to do things, I suppose. So I was the army officer who was put in this combined defence headquarters. In there also was the wing commander in charge of 2 Squadron, and Kim Benithan was a pilot there in 2 Squadron.
Yeah.
I see he's just given the black painting to...
Yes.
Yeah. I got a black painting for the... there it is. The little girl there, for Season of Sarsaparilla.
Yeah.
That's John Brake. Yeah. Well, that's a copy of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, Rofe, Wing Commander Headlam. And so I got to know Brian Rofe fairly well. In fact, when we were shot up, he had won the... Getting a bit long-winded, but he had won the 100 yards athletics race in Adelaide University in 1939. But after we looked out on this combined thing and saw it was safe to take off, we took off for the slit trenches, and I raced him easily. In fact, I met his widow the other day and reminded her of this. So I knew Rofe fairly well. And after they evacuated, he was in charge of the party that was left there and evacuated and got up the north coast and got taken off. All right, we come back. So I finished my PAS degree. I started honours. I was approached by Rofe, who was a recruiting officer at Long Range Weapons Establishment, LRWE. He's taken a mate of mine the year before. they were setting up the second batch of recruits for LRWE. They sent the first lot to in about 1940. seven or eight. There was a small group of about six, I think. One of whom was a friend of mine, that Wren Keats. He'd been in the 2nd 48th, the battalion. I mentioned him before. His nickname was Spira. Yeah. Anyway, Rovey approached me, and I agreed to be one of their cadets. So Didi and I got married. We went off to England. We were told that because there had been... Now, I've got to be a bit careful here because this stuff's got a red secret stamp on it. It's all down below. We'd been told that Australians in England were not being trusted by American security.
Mm.
Something had happened with somebody in the CSIRO. I don't know what it was. Anyway, so I agreed to go on this thing because we were told by Brian Rove that because Australians were not trusted, they would not work in these secret establishments, ANARI, I've forgotten what they're called in England, but they'd be sent to universities and able to do PhDs. So I was on the understanding that I would be able to get to Cambridge and get a PhD. Short circuit the, because you didn't have to have an honours degree to start research degrees in Cambridge. So we get there, and I get told by the people in Australia House, Dear Medlin, this is to tell you what you will do in England. You'll work at... I've forgotten what the place was called on the computer. What's the place in England, the home of rugby?
Do you mean rugby school? Arnold's school?
No. Where the Oxford-Cambridge rugby is.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, anyway. Down in this suburb, anyway, there was this this crowd. They were working on the ACE computer. Now, they picked me because the work that I did here was to write, said to you earlier, write the first comparative study between analog and digital computing.
Mm.
And I did it all in the research centre in the state library, public documents. I take it out, and I didn't even keep a copy of the damn thing. And the bloke grabbed it and put top secret on it, and red thing, and I've never seen it from that day to this. So I guess that's why they picked me to work on ACE. So I did do them the courtesy of going down there. And, it would have been terrible. It was shocking. It was about as big as this room, you know, wires and everything. You see, we're talking about 1949. This is before the transistor.
Mm.
None of this leery business like you've got here. So I went up to Cambridge and I saw a fella called Philip Bowden. And he was an Australian. He'd been a Rhodes Scholar from Tasmania. And he had vacancies in his lab. And I'd taken references from Kerr Grant, from Joe Wood, Doc Burden, still got them. And they said about this ex-prisoner of war who'd done so well, Anyway, two of us went up there, a fella called Neil Jones and Harry Medlin. Neil Jones finished his tour, actually, at LRWE. And it was his wife who set up the that theatre down at Brighton. Anyway, I was selected. I got on very well with Philip Bowden. I had trouble with him, with Australia House.
Mm.
I can't go into the details of the trouble. There was a Royal Commission here. Some years ago, on intelligence and security. I gave evidence the Royal Commissioner was the Chancellor. I knew him quite well, the Chancellor of Which university was it? Not Macquarie. One of them, anyway. He subsequently became governor of New South Wales. It was all very, very unpleasant. We came back to Australia. My sister, who was 3 years younger than me, had a baby in January the 5th, one day after my birthday of 1949, had an ovarian cancer. I was given MA status in Cambridge at Gonville and Caius College. I saw the master, Chadwick.
Oh, yeah.
You know, discoverer of the neutron.
Yes.
And Philip Bowden. Intermitted my course because my sister had to be looked after. Anyway, when we got back here, it was just hopeless. Dottie and I stayed with them. They had a house down at Brighton. My mother was there. There were now two kids, one who was two, and a baby that had just been born. And Dottie and I, my sister then died in June. Mm-hmm. And I intermitted my Cambridge course, enrolled in a PhD here, and finished my PhD here in here in Adelaide. I've been back to Caius since. Mm. I am a life member of the Caius College Club. They're trying to get money out of me. And what's new? So, anyway, I saw quite a bit of Brian Roth, but he then left. He then left LRWE and took a job, I think, over in Kangaroo Island doing something. He died very early with some sort of cancer. Patty's widow is Paul's mother.
Yes.
Do you know Pat Roth?
No.
Yeah. She's a war widow. They're Catholics. There was a daughter, Deirdre. She became a mother superior, and she and Dottie got on well together. I think she was a mother superior in somewhere in Victoria. Anyway, she died early. The family is predisposed to early deaths, and yet poor Rafe's smoking like a chimney still. God.
So, Harry, I'm afraid I've been remiss in not asking you about your time in the Adelaide Union and SRC. I should have done that earlier, but I wonder, even though it's a step out of chronology, would you mind stepping back and talking about that?
No, that's all right.
How did you become involved?
God. Yeah, I'm sillier than you might think. Say the first couple of years, I had to recover. In fact, I had terrible problems with my heart. I had dry beriberi in prison camp and had tachycardia and a thing called myocarditis, whatever the hell it is. But used to beat irregularly. And I was outside the physics department one day. There's a water faucet there, and it stopped. And I reckon it stopped for about 10 seconds. And all of a sudden it went wham, and just about blew my head off.
Mm.
The blood that came. And I've been interviewed by the Australian War Film Archives, and I think I told you they did 13 hours. God. And I said to the girl, I hope it doesn't happen again. And she said, well, I hope it doesn't happen tonight. Which, so it never has happened again, but it'll happen one day, of course. Yeah. It comes to all of us. So I had to be careful. But I was doing quite well, and I remember when we had the first meeting of Physics 3 in what would have been February, March of 1947, Doc Burden called out names. Because what you do, you go in there. We never enrolled in time. You go, just go in there and put your name on the roll card. And Burden would come in and say, Kitts, Medlin, and you'd answer. Anyway, Barbara Potts and David Sutton, who he often beat me. I always beat her, but he often beat me in physics. They were sitting up the back, and this fella Keats and I were down the front. And he said, he called out Medlin. I said, yeah. And I heard Barbara Kidner say, "That's Medlin," because they didn't know who the hell I was, because they hadn't seen me in 1946, because I just go to the lectures and go home and go to sleep.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how she got to know me. Anyway, I cleaned her up in Physics 3. And when I in 1948, when I was better, I started to be active. And she came to me and said, "Would you be the Science Association nominee to the SAC?" And in that address that I gave to the women's club,
yes,
I mentioned it there, that so any culpability for any subsequent political misbehaviour is...
Barbara's fault.
...is hers. So anyway, I got onto the... I agreed to get onto the SAC. Then, as I say, I met Diana Walkup, who was the president of the Women's Union, as I said earlier, and I started to get quite active. And, I don't know, they put me up to be vice president. John Roeder. You know him?
I know of him, yes.
Yeah. John Roeder was president, and there was an election for vice president. And there were two of us, Bill Bray, John Bray's brother, and Harry Medlin. And I won it. there were several responsibilities for the vice president. You had to run any elections for officers. You had to adjudicate at the SRC debates. That was a pretty tricky job, I tell you, in those days. And you had to be the censor for On Deed. In fact, I got a letter in there from Gil Warquist, who saw that article in the Weekend Australian magazine, and I must... I refused to censor On Deed. I mean, Gil Warquist was the editor. He could put in what he liked, as far as I was concerned. And A.P. Rowe had become Vice Chancellor.
Yeah.
God. He used to come down and talk to us. I can still see him in the George Murray Library. That's the upstairs room. I think it's been divided now, the upstairs room in the George Murray building. We used to have our meetings in there. And Rowe had come, and he was a little fella. And there were seats along the side, and I could still see him. Here we are. And he'd get up on this bloody seat, and he'd harangue us about bad language and disrespect for the chapel. And but we had all sorts of... There was getting to be Muslims there, and we used to have prayer things for them, and it was open season on... Atheists had a right to be there as well as other people. But he was something else, A.P. Wright. So I got quite active in the SRC. I became the patron of the Science Association. And... Rex Jury's brother was president of the thing, I think one of the years, Rod Jury, who went off and worked with Bob Crompton in the ANU. I used to give the patron's address of these things. They made me a life member. Yeah, the idea is to tell a lot of lies and... Then I became I was doing a lot of research work and used to work at night, so I'd have tea in the in the refectory. And Frank Borland, I got to know Frank Borland. He was the first warden of the union.
Yeah.
I got to know him quite well. And he used to have tea there too. And of course, we're talking now about the Colombo plan.
Yes.
And because, you know, I'd been in Asia, I got to know a lot of those Colombo plan people. There was one in particular, Iskanto. Iskanto subsequently became a major general in the Indonesian Air Force. Mm. And he's got a camp on. He bought up a whole lot of houses in Jakarta. He's got this beautiful camp. The trouble is, you go there, you have to eat durian, which, when he came to enroll, he goes to the office and they say, "What's your name?" He said, "Iskanto." They said, "What's your other name?" He said, "I haven't got another name." He said, "What's your Christian name?" And he said, "I'm a Muslim." He said, "Oh, you have to have another name." He said, "Call me Raden." Do you speak any Indonesian?
No.
Raden is prince. Now, we supported the revolution, independence, Merdeka Tetap. Anyway, when they got their independence, and through the United Nations, which Australia supported, all those titles were abolished, except the Sultan of Yogyakarta. Now, the Sultan of Yogyakarta, there's still the Sultan of Yogyakarta, it's the only one in Indonesia, and he was allowed to keep it because he supported the revolution. He supported Merdeka, and I've been there, I've met him, I've met the father of the present one. So, as I say, Raden, there was no such thing as Raden. So the other Indonesians say, "Hey, this clown's calling himself Raden." Now, if you look in the in the list of graduates, you'll see Iskanto, Raden, B.E., whatever it was. So, anyway, we start the Colombo plan. I know the present heads of our alumni association in Kuala Lumpur, in Kuching, in Kota Kinabalu, in Singapore. Mm-hmm. I knew them all. The Chief Minister of Sarawak tribe, I'm giving him his doctorate degree there. And Didi taught his wife. So there were a lot of connections. Anyway, they wanted somebody to chair the Union Hall. Was set up in 1958. Mm-hmm. It was opened finally in 1958 by A.P. Rowe. And to be fair to Rowe, Rowe was very supportive of student activities. In his book, If the Gown Fits, he talks about all sorts of student and union activities. And indeed, he encouraged the public appeal for the the Union Hall. The Union Hall was built the third, I used to know the figures, a third from the public appeal, third from the Union, and the third from the Adelaide University provided by A.P. Rowe. The first chair of the Hall Committee was Henry Baston.
Oh, right.
But he only did it for a short time. I made a list in 1968 of the first 10 years. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
But no, I haven't.
I can give you a copy if you remind me. he was the first chairman. Then there was a fellow called Smythe. And I think Smythe had been a Rhodes Scholar. And he came back and took over from Henry Baston. Then he got that skin cancer.
Mm.
What's it called?
Melanoma.
Yeah. Oh, God, and it knocked him out in about 6 months. So then they conned me into doing it. And I got conned because I'd been stage manager of the Seat of Your Pants and other things. Stage managed the review that we did at the National Union Council. It was National Union Council in the end of 1948 in New England. And previous to that was a Congress in Tullabudgera. You know, Tullabudgera is almost on the border of New South Wales and Queensland. And nobody seems to know where the bloody border is. New South Wales says it's the other side of the whatever the river is, and Queensland says it's this side, and somebody says it's in the middle. Anyway, I've never seen anything like it. Seen some rough stuff in the army, but as for kids, you know, getting drunk and stupid, and anyway, I was older and older than them and was getting pretty fit, so I stage managed a review. I got this review together. So they thought I'd be a good bloke to make chair of the Union Hall Committee. So I became chair of that and stayed there for about 16 years, I think. Ran the Union Hall. Ran it at a profit. God. Now, even the Theatre Guild doesn't put on anything there. You know, seats 499.
Yeah.
And all they do is play in the little theatre. And I got support from the Elizabethan Theatre Trust to get people like John Tasker do those world premieres.
Yes.
God. Because there was no professional theatre here. And White wanted Tasker, and they were both homosexuals, but we're different partners, and they had a big falling out, of course. And then I was one of those responsible for setting up the South Australian Theatre Company with the then manager, general manager of the Commonwealth Bank, who signed all the pound notes, whatever his name was, little fella.
What, Nugget?
Yeah, Coombs.
Yeah.
He wanted me to go on the Australian Elizabethan Theatre Trust, and I said, not with you, mate. Yeah, Nugget Coombs. Glenn McBride was the local manager. Glenn McBride, do you remember the York Theatre?
Yes. Well, I know where it was.
Yeah,
I know where it was.
They knocked it down.
Yeah.
Well, we used to go there every Friday night, and Glenn McBride used to sell his own tickets. The Waterman brothers would have killed him if they'd known what he was up to. You could go and get a ticket from the box office, or if you saw McBride, you can go and get it. Oh, God. Anyway, he and Tasker. Now, the first two productions they did were in Theatre 62 with John Edmund. John got caught soliciting in Elder Park and got put in jail. He was to have produced Noah's Flood, but he was in jail. So someone else produced it, and I got him to do Fisher's Ghost in the 1962... The second festival did Fisher's Ghost. And Max Lampshed was, you probably know the Lampshed. And Max Lampshed was the secretary of the festival. I got on quite well with him, but didn't get on well with the governors at all.
Yeah.
Although finally I got on quite well with Jim Irwin. I met his son's widow the other day. So, I became chair of the hall committee. So the Theatre Guild was having trouble. They had Alex Simons.
Yes.
Yeah, Alex. Oh. He was probably a fairly useful deputy of the Housing Trust. But he knew nothing about the theatre. Anyway, they got rid of him, and they thought Beryl Pierce, in particular, she was the vice chancellor secretary, and she thought, well, if they could con me into becoming the president of the Theatre Guild, they might get special access to the Union Hall, which is exactly what happened. So I then became chairman of the Hall Committee and president of the University Theatre Guild. And our first production was that, the Lysistrata of Aristophanes, the Love War.
Yeah.
And that drawing of Lysistrata is copied from Norman Lindsay's, what was his son's name?
Hal.
Yeah. I've got his book down there. Mm. And Lindsay illustrated Lysistrata, but it was banned, of course, but it's not signed. There's no acknowledgement who did the illustration, but you can tell. I mean, anyone who knows Norman Lindsay knows that's him. Anyway, with the woman holding up her hand and stopping the men with their swords are great, their spears are great phallus. You can see the phallic symbolism there. But the big drawing is a copy. And if you look carefully at it, you'll see that I made Stanislaw Kukoski right after NL on the toe of God. But that's right, Norman Lindsay. Now, when we used that we filled the Union Hall with the thing, of course. And when they first published it, they took that shading off, and I hit the roof and said, "Why? Why have you done that?" And they said, "Pubic hair." I said, "Haven't you ever seen pubic hair? It's a shadow." So I made them put it back on. We got John Bray. John Bray was not then the Chief Justice. He was a friend of my brother's and Charles Jury, and I got John to come to the dress rehearsals, the last two dress rehearsals. The first dress rehearsal, and he said, "Well, you better take that out and take that out and take that out." So we took them out on the last dress rehearsal and on the first night. And it's just as well we did, because the chief secretary then was a fellow called Lyle McEwen.
Oh, yes.
Do you know his nickname?
Was it, no, not him.
Lyle McRuin. Oh, God. Anyway, he had the place full of cops, and I was backstage, and I tell you what, the seduction scene in the cave, oh God, Ed Pegg, you know Ed Pegg?
No.
You don't?
No.
Oh, he's a well-known Adelaide actor, and he goes overseas directing now for the Royal Shakespeare, and he gives the poetry prize at St. Peter's College, and Ed Pegg. God, the parties we used to have at Eden Hills. After one of them, he took Joan Bruce, what a very slapping block, and they fell down. God. Anyway, Ed Pegg is supposed to... Wow. Young fellas... It's a bit hard for him being seduced by seductresses. Very embarrassing. I'll tell you another bloke. Herodias. What's the play? Not Exit the King. The daughter of Herod, anyway, who had terrible, terrible trouble with the bloke there being seduced by her, gets quite embarrassing.
So this happened in Union Hall, full of police, did it?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you get away with it?
Des?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, we put it all back after. After the police went off, gone. No, we revolutionised the Adelaide Theatre, because previous to that had been the Rep.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
And they were all very well presented. Very appropriate, no swearing. I think the first swearing I ever heard in the Union Hall was done by Footlights. Anne Dibden?
Yeah.
You know Anne?
No, I've heard, yes, I've heard of her.
They had one of these sketches, you know, the Union Hall had a big curtain. And they had a telephone booth set up there, and about 40 people came crashed into the telephone booth. Of course, they get out the back of it. She went in there first, and they get out the back, and then the lights come up, and she walks out, goes right down the front of the apron and says, "Shit!" nobody had ever said that.
So it changed things around.
Yeah.